Jim Turbert, host of Feel Free to Deviate, your new favorite podcast. This is the fourth episode of Feel Free to Deviate, and I'm going to keep the intro short because things are crazy. I have so much to do, and I need to get out the door, and besides that, the episode is long, and it sort of explains itself. I know you're not supposed to drink hot beverages, but... Today's conversation is with Dave Tang Olson. He's an old and dear friend of mine, and he is an assistant professor of art at Wellesley College. If you listen to the other episodes of this, you may have gathered that I've previously worked at Wellesley College. So yeah, we met each other there. It's a great place to meet people. Fantastic. I realized that previously I probably didn't outline this, but this podcast releases every 2 weeks. And as far as I know, you can get it on any of the major podcast directories. I'm also starting social media accounts. Well, I have started them, but there's nothing on them. Maybe by the time you hear this, there'll be something, but not much. Honestly, I haven't done enough research about what podcasts put on social media, so I'm going to do that. If you could send me a message to mail@feelfreetodeviate.com making suggestions for content for social media, I'd appreciate it, because honestly, on my social media, I just post pictures of stuff, and I don't even use Facebook anymore, but now I feel like I have to because I'm doing a podcast. It's really weird. But I'm going to do it, because I want to do it right, and Facebook is the way, at least for now. I could just stop and say, no, I'm not going to do this. So yeah, if you could send me a message, that'd be great. Like I said, this is going to be a short introduction, so here's Dave. I invited you here today because I'm a middle-aged guy who never figured out what he wanted to be when he grew up. From my perspective, you have figured a few things out. I know who you are, but please introduce yourself and tell us what you do in general or specific terms.
Hey, Jim. Thank you so much for having me. This is a great, great pleasure of mine to be able to speak to my buddy. My name is David Tang Olson. I am a artist slash professor slash all around happy guy. And I'm talking to you from Wellesley, Massachusetts, where it's, you know, in the low 90s today. So I'm a little sweaty. I actually had the AC on before this interview just to kind of cool off the room. And I had to turn it off, obviously, because I didn't want
the sound. We want maximum sound quality for the pod.
Yeah, I'm originally from Seattle, Washington, and migrated east as far as I could in the continental United States of America.
That is true. That is very true. And we're going to get to that. My first follow-up question, because I'm a professional interviewer now, is what did you want to be when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, I had a best friend named Joaquin, and the two of us were like very, very into the military. We would dress up in fatigues. We'd go to the Army surplus store and buy canteens and utility belts and, you know, hats, medals, anything that could make us seem like we were like the coolest military kids on the planet. We would kind of debate which was better. Do you want to be in the Army? Do you want to be in the Air Force? So that really was like something that I thought I was going to do for a very long time. What's interesting is my friend Joaquin actually did join the military. He went to the Air Force and he did a tour of duty in Saudi Arabia. I, on the other hand, didn't quite want to join the military. I think I did try to go to like the military academy. I did try, but I wasn't cut out to be, I wasn't smart enough. I'll just be honest with you.
Come on, you're not smart enough? How could that possibly be?
Well,
what were you applying for?
For what I wanted to do. It was like I wanted to go to the military academy in like Annapolis, right? My decision was go to the Navy. I didn't have the
grades. You need like a senator to recommend you to get in there.
Exactly. Stuff. And I actually tried. So my dad works for the state, right? So He was trying to get... He mentioned it one time, I'll try to get, you know, the governor to like give you a pass. And obviously I don't even think he tried, but my alternative was to go to the Cal Maritime in California to at least like become, I wanted to be like an engineer in a ship. I actually had a friend who went to Cal Maritime, actually the woman I went to prom with, Mari Wells.
And, hey, Mari.
And I flew down to California. It's in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I went and stayed the night at this Maritime Academy. And I got like a real glimpse of what the military was actually like. And it scared the bejesus out of me. I immediately went home and erased any inkling of ever wanting to go into the military after that moment. So it was a good experience to like erase that. I had to like hurry up and come up with some other vision for my future, because that had like literally been what I thought about all the time. I knew I didn't want to go to the military after that experience. I also, this is kind of digressing a little bit, you know, my father was an artist. I knew of like from a very young age, I never wanted to be an artist because my father was an artist and he was a tragic, tragic hero, soul, whatever you want to call it. It was just very, very, it was also very discouraging. So those were like the kind of the two things at that moment in time when I was like, you know, 18 years old that I knew I didn't want to do. Obviously,
you can't escape your destiny, Dave.
Yeah, you can't escape it.
Just your destiny.
So that's so at a young age. Yeah, that's all I thought about.
All right. Now I'm going to try to remember what you just said, because I was thinking immediately, how did that work out for Joaquin? Was he into it?
Yeah, well, Joaquin, he was not into it. So he joined the Air Force. I don't really know what happened. He ended up becoming a military police officer, since he was actually like living the dream. We like to say,
sorry for laughing.
our childhood dream. You know, I was always like, hey, Joaquin, what's it like? He's like, yeah, it's not what I ever thought it was going to be. You know, it's hot here. It's like 150 degrees, or, you know, he would always talk about like how hot it was. And I was like, well, what's it like to be in Saudi Arabia? Well, he's like, it's interesting. It's like the base that we're on is basically the size of San Francisco. You know, I don't know if this is true, but this is what he described. Like, imagine San Francisco, and that's how big our base is. But I'm like, oh, that's pretty big. He's like, yeah, and we can't leave the base. And I was like, oh, why not? He's like, well, before, yes, when we were in your station in Saudi Arabia, you'd be able to like go out and, you know, check out the town. He said, but what happened was, is you'd go and check out the town and you'd turn a corner and you'd come across like a stoning of a human being.
Oh, wow.
or a hand chopping offing. So we decided that, you know, maybe we shouldn't let people wander off the base to like witness something that
might traumatize them forever. Yeah. A friend of mine from high school joined the Coast Guard, and he was all gung ho about it. He loved the basic training, you know, all the camaraderie and all the whole, yeah, I'm a true man thing. But he got really bummed out. Like, basically he was in Florida, and basically he was just constantly turning away refugees, you know, like, how disheartening is that? Your job is to, like, these desperate people want to come and you're just like, nope, sorry, dude, laters, over and over and over again. I don't think it's a good life. I mean, unless you really hate foreigners.
Exactly. He definitely gave like a vivid description of it, and it didn't seem like a great thing. Yeah, he was a professional poker player after that.
Nice.
And then now he sells cars. And yeah, we're still
good living.
Friendly. Yeah, yeah. Toyotas and a good car on top of that.
Reliable. You get your money's worth with Toyota. Hey, Toyota, if you want to sponsor this podcast, I'm your guy. Toyota. Nice, solid cars. I got distracted. Now we talked about Joaquin. Oh, yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to follow up on was a similar experience that I had. I mean, not with the military, but when I was in high school, I was a football player. I was pretty decent, and I went on a recruiting weekend to a small engineering college in upstate New York to play Division III football, which is very low stakes. Nobody knows anything about Division III football. But I went there. My mom drove me up. I stayed in the dorms with some guys, and we went to a party, basically. And then we went to another party, and there was a pre-party with just dudes drinking a lot. And then there was the next party, and there were a couple of girls there. And then we went to a proper house. I don't know if it was a frat or if it was just a giant house or whatever, but each party got worse, and the people became not physically ugly, but I hated it so much. I'm not going to say it was the worst night of my life. First of all, before everybody was drunk, we're just standing around with all these prospective football players and everyone's just talking about their stats. I was a pretty good football player, but I don't know what my stats are. I just played because I like to play and, you know, I did a good job. And these guys are like, yeah, this number sucks. And so that was insanely boring to start with. Had nothing in common with any of these dudes. And then they just start getting drunker and drunker. And then they're having fun. And as you know, I do not drink. I just stayed as sober as the most sober guy in the world. In this college frat house scene, people started coming up to me saying, "You're stoned right now, aren't you? You're stoned."
Totally stoned.
Dude, it's okay if you're fucked up. Dude, it's okay. It's like, no, I'm not. But, you know, thank you for your permission to get fucked up. And then one guy kept telling me that I looked like, what's his name? Kim Thayil from Soundgarden. Because I had long hair. Like, first of all, I look nothing like that dude. Like, I don't know what his ethnicity is, but he doesn't look like me. He has darker skin. He has curlyish hair. I mean, we both had long hair.
Right.
That was the extent of us looking like. Anyway, at some point in the night, I just left. It was freezing. Was it Schenectady or... I don't remember. It was one of those upstate towns that's freezing cold in the middle of the winter.
Yeah.
And I just walked back to the dorm, went to bed, got up as early as I could and didn't go to the next session of stuff for the recruiting. I was just like, nope, not into this. Yeah. I'm gone. This is the worst. And I left. But anyway, you decided that it wasn't for you. I decided that that wasn't for me. Perhaps exactly. I should have made a different decision. But what's the next step?
Not really knowing what I was going to do. I was very fortunate. You know, I did get into some other colleges. I didn't like put all my eggs in one basket. I also applied to Western Washington University, which was in Bellingham, which is in the same town that I went to high school, which is actually next door. So that was like, you know, a pretty safe bet. And then I also applied to the University of Washington and I got in there, fortunately. And I applied to like Cal Berkeley and Stanford. I did not get into those schools, but I thought it'd be cool to, you know, go back to California where it's like sunny and nice, but I didn't even get a response. I must have like filled the application out wrong.
You sent it to the wrong building.
Damn it, Dave. I mean, back in those days, I had like zero help from my family or
Tell
the school counselor.
It.
They're just like, "Oh, are you going to go to college?" I'm like, "Yeah, I guess." They're like, "Well,
good luck.
Fill out applications and do it." I was like, "Okay, you know, there's no internet or, you know," I was like, "Okay, then what do? You get to like mail a letter.
You get these crappy books."
Yeah. And so at least I did like enough due diligence to like get into a school. So I decided I wanted to go to the University of Washington to get out of my hometown, right? I thought like, maybe that's a good step. Like I'll go to the University of Washington in Seattle. It's actually where my dad also went to school and graduated from. So I thought, oh, that'd be nice.
It is your destiny.
And yeah, it was something. But I guess the cool part about it is my Aunt Julie, her really good friend from when she was in her 20s and her younger years, ran the photo lab in the basement of Ain Hall. And it was a photo lab that supported, it was called Classroom Support Services. And basically what they did is they provided faculty with slides for their lectures. It also had a black and white photo lab that printed prints for publications from the archives that included, you know, Imogene Cunningham's work, you know, lots of archival footage. The Curtis brothers is another name that was in that archive. So anyways, she's like, "Hey, you should go meet my friend Stan Shockey. And, you know, if you want to, you can probably work in this photo lab and you'll have a job and you'll be able to like get a little money and learn a skill." And I was like, "Oh, that sounds great." So I went in the summer before my freshman year started. I moved into like the temporary dorms. And this had a profound impact on like the rest of my life. So I went to this photo lab. I'd never developed film in my life. My sister took black and white photography in high school. Like, I was like, Christina, I need a crash course. Like,
how do I do this?
What is all this stuff that I'm going to interact with? She's like, well, you know, and she like kind of showed me her stuff out, and it didn't like sink in. I was like, I have no idea what's going on.
No, you kind of have to do it.
Yeah. So I met Stan, and it was in the basement of the large lecture hall on campus. And he said, like, you're hired. Wow. And I was like, what do you want? He's like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I don't know. I'm thinking about maybe studying medicine or science, something like that. He's like, you'll be an artist.
No, he didn't.
Like, yeah, he did. He said, you'll be an artist. Don't worry. It's just what happens. This, you know, this job's going to like, you know, make you want to do art. I was like, okay. And he put me to work immediately. He took me to the back of the photo lab. There's a huge, not, you know, a really large lighting studio with like 20-foot ceilings, you know, probably like maybe a couple thousand square feet. And inside the studio, there was like a life-size sculptures of firefighters, you know, putting out a fire.
Why?
Because they were photographing it.
These sculptures?
For like some of these portfolios. The actual sculptures. That's how big the lab was, right?
That's so crazy.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, that's pretty interesting. And then he took me to the corner and he was like, this is going to be your first job here. And I was like, oh, okay. What is that? And he's like, you're going to make copy negatives or safety negatives of these prints. And I was like, okay, what's that? He's like, this is the camera. And it's basically a camera. It's just about as big as like a dining room table. It, you know, has bellows. It's on rails. It's like a World War II copy camera that they use to make copies of satellite pictures and things like that to mail off. You can do like up to like 11 by 14 negatives on it.
Holy crap. That's amazing.
That's how big the bellows were. And it had like this like kind of glass table that you could put photos in, shut the glass, you know, it was like had clips.
Yeah,
you'd
yeah,
lift
yeah.
that glass up and then you would take photos. And he is like, all right, here you go. This is what you're going to do. Here's this giant stack of 8x10 contact prints that they made from like the original glass. They were like glass contacts from glass, 8x10 glass negatives. Yeah. They were, and you're going to make safety, you know, negatives, like basically backups of these glass negatives, right? So
that is super cool.
Yeah, right?
That is really, really cool.
I know. My mind was like blown. I was like, this is all so unfamiliar, but also probably just like so antiquated and strange. And
definitely so, antiquated.
So I would put these, like, you know, 8x10 contacts into this camera, and he showed me the 4x5 film, and they're all like, they're in loaders.
Oh, you were backing them up on 4x5?
Yeah, 4x5, okay. Safety negatives. Yeah. So he said, like, you know, there isn't that much to know about this because this camera is already set up. So he would just show me exactly what settings to put them at.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would put the film in, you know, pull the black piece of, you know.
Dark slide, Dave. It's called the dark slide.
Dark slide. Yeah, there you go. See, still don't know the terminology, even though I did this for 10 years of my life. And then I would shut the shutter. And by the end, I had 20 pieces of exposed film that I needed to develop. And he's like, okay, good job. You know, this took like, you know, a few hours of me like sweating. Like, he just left. Like, you know, so I did this. And he's like, okay, now you're going to develop the film. I'm like, okay, so down the hall from this large studio, there was a narrow long room with a huge sink that went from one side of the room to the other. Three stainless steel tanks full of like some stinky chemistry. He's like, okay, now we're going to develop the film. This takes about 20 minutes and you're going to be in the pitch black. And I was like,
And you've never done it before.
Whoa, I've never done it before.
And are you using trays or hangers? Probably hangers.
Hangers, yeah. So he closes the door. Turns out the lights, like he didn't really say much too, which is even more awesome. Like he just like kind of would be like, all right, next we're going to do this. And we just go to the room. He turn off the lights. I just hear all this like noise and shuffling
a
next
fan,
to me. Like
some weird fan.
Yeah. Him like opening all the holders, putting the film. And he would like kind of grab my hand sometimes. Just like, this is the hanger. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to like flip
find
the little
springy
top
thing.
And spot it. Yeah. And then he's like, this is the tray,
tank. You know,
the film holder tank. So he did all this stuff and like, it was just clinking and clanking and like, you know, weird little noises. And he kind of like would be like, okay, pick it up. And then he like grabbed my shoulders and turned me around. And then he's like, now put it in tray number one. I was like, tray number one. You know, I ducked it in. I set the timer for like 5 minutes. I did that. And then that like became my job.
You were just shooting these things and processing 4x5 sheet film all day.
Every day. Yeah. All day, you know, like 3 hours a day, 2 hours a day. And it was like my part-time job. Right. So, but actually for those that first month, it was like a full-time job. I just went there for 8 hours a day. I made $2 an hour or $1.75 an hour.
That's big money.
Yeah. It was big money back then. I mean, tuition was only like $400 a quarter. So I was able to.
that's fairly reasonable.
Cost. Yeah.
That's almost, that's manageable.
So yeah, I did that. And then I did start to like photography. I never took pictures before that, but I had like an unlimited supply of film.
That's a pretty sweet connect.
Yeah, we would load film. So we would get 100-foot rolls.
Oh, yeah.
You know, T-Max 400. And that, like, one of my other jobs was to, like, you know, load
cartridges.
Cartridges.
Got and, canisters, whatever.
Film cartridges. And then I'd be able to use them. And then I would develop my pictures. You know, I wasn't super proactive printing the film. So, like, just during the pandemic, I was looking, you know, for things to do because I'm inside. And I found lots of negatives that I had never, ever printed.
I saw some on Instagram.
Yeah. I was scanning. Yeah, and it was cool because they were photos that I definitely had never... I might have had a contact sheet on of them, some of them, but not all of them. You know, some of them were just unknown negatives. But to go back, I took this job, and then a lot of the other people, like the people who were printers, I was like the studio copy negative guy. But then they hired a lot of photo students that printed all day. So there'd be like 5 or 6 undergrad photo students that would come in and print all these photos in the dark room. So I like started hanging out with these artsy kids, and they seemed fun and interesting. And they were always like working on like really kind of, you know, at the time I thought were like nonsensical projects. Like this guy's like, look at this. I made a movie of myself as a bee. I was like, I don't even know what that means.
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Is that an actual example? Was it himself as a bee?
Yes, it was a bee. So, you know, he would take pictures of himself. I don't know if he had a timer or what, but he would, you know, he would jump up in the air and like, you know, put his
knee. People, kids, what was like
that called? A rotoscope. I mean, it's like huge now, right? You see it all over, but it's pretty complicated to do that back you know, 90s, right? So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of, I mean, I'm going to be honest, there's a lot of really cute girls that worked there.
That's a bonus. So, I mean, we're talking, this is a long time ago. You're, you know, early 20s, late teens. That is perhaps the biggest bonus of any job.
Right. I mean, let's be honest right now.
I worked in an ice cream shop.
Yeah.
You know, like not only is there ice cream, but there's also cute girls.
Yeah. So I was like, man, how do I take these classes where all these like girls are at? There was other reasons I started taking art classes, but.
But it was mostly the girls.
Yeah, it took a 2D design course.
So what you're telling me is that it wasn't the passion to create. It wasn't a singular vision that drove you to the art department.
Absolutely not. It was like, I'm going to take a class where there's like some cute girls. And I wanted something too that wasn't as hard. So
yeah. Art is hard, dude.
No, it was, I mean, yes, it's hard.
It but can like be.
The other course I was taking, so I was like, so I ended up joining what was called a cohort of engineering students. Like they asked you, what do you want to be? I was like, I still kind of thought, I was like, maybe I'll still be an engineer. You know, I had a cohort of all these other freshmen and we all took classes together. And I took calculus, English composition, and I think there had to be like a science course in there as well. It might have been biology or 101 or something like that. But I failed all of those classes.
Excellent. Well done.
I mean, and I remember it was like so devastating too, because calculus was like, how many of you are pre-med? And like, you know, half the class was in their head. He's like, you will all fail. He's like, it's less than 1% of you will, you know, go on to continue this. I was like, wow, this is like kind of a dick thing to say to like these freshmen. So that was discouraging. And
it's like in the movies, it's like a scene out of a movie.
It is.
Like the, really- all these scared freshmen are sitting in the, or first years are sitting in the audience thinking, oh, this guy's scary. He's not scary. If they knew him, he's just a guy who goes home and he gets wasted. His wife hates him.
Yeah, exactly. I dropped that class pretty early on, and then I switched to pre-calculus. And I took the night course because I heard from somebody like if you take the night courses, they're easier because it's like a bunch of old people.
Yeah, right.
Are trying to go back to school.
They go slower for the old brains.
I actually have a really funny story about that guy. I can't remember his name, but he was my pre-calculus teacher at night, and he was very nice. I think he was like even nicer. I mean, this is like projecting and kind of because the story goes on, you'll understand why. And he's like, I didn't really know the answers, but he kind of still gave me some credit. I was like, wow, this is really great. Like, I'm going to pass this class. It wasn't doing me any favors because I wasn't really learning calculus.
Right.
But this same gentleman, I really wish I remembered his name.
It's okay. We probably shouldn't say it.
Yeah.
If his story is going anyway. Where I think it might be going.
Yeah. It's going in a dark path. You know, so I would see him around on campus because we're just both on campus. And one day I was out taking pictures. And he's like, oh, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I'm a photographer for the university. I didn't tell him I just took pictures of pictures all day long, but I was like, oh, so you're a photographer. He's like, well, I really want my picture taken.
Yeah, of course he does.
Oh, okay. And he's like, well, will you come over to my house and take some pictures of me? And I was like, yeah, I guess so.
Oh,
and he's like, well, I mean, like a special kind of picture. I was like, elaborate. Yeah, I mean, I can do your portrait or whatever. He's like, well, I was thinking, you know, more like, you know, some like nude pictures.
Boudoir.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah.
It's not really my scene, man.
Yeah. I don't really think that's, I don't do that kind of stuff. He's like, oh, yeah, of course not. Of course not. But he's like, can I have your number anyway and stuff? And I was like, yeah, sure. So he called me like once or twice, and I just like had a conversation with him about like how's teaching, you know? Like, oh, that's good.
How's teaching? The kids are really learning a lot. It's great. I feel so fulfilled. By the way, would you like to come over to my house after work?
Exactly. I just was like naive and didn't know what was going on.
I mean, it's a common. The guys like that are predators, though. They see it's a real thing. I have a similar story. It's not with photography, but there was this guy. I think he just liked long haired dudes. And my roommate was also a long haired dude delivering liquor downtown in Boston. This guy got his number saying, oh, you're a jazz student. You want to come over and do the thing? You know, like, yeah, we can talk about jazz. Like this guy had his game. He was like on it, like super smart dude. He could talk about anything. So when Kevin said that he was a jazz student, he just started talking about jazz. And Kevin was like, awesome, we can jam. Here's my number. We'll do the thing. But what he didn't know is that Kevin had a girlfriend. And whenever he called the house, I was the only one home because I did not have a girlfriend. So he was just like, oh, well, do you want to come and hang out? I was like, yeah. Like I just moved to Boston. I have zero friends. This is awesome. I will come and hang out. I mean, how bad could he be? He's a friend of Kevin's. And it was like, it was very similar. Like the night just got weirder and weirder and weirder until he was touching my leg. And I was just like, dude, I got to go. I really got to go. I felt so awkward. Yeah. I didn't feel like I was in danger. So I can't say it's a similar situation that maybe a woman might find herself in where it would be dangerous.
Right.
Like I was twice this guy's size, but still,
yeah, like,
mentally he was playing games and I was like, I don't know, 19 years old. And it was really confusing and weird for me. And anyway, it was a similar thing. But the thing I say that these guys are predators or that they have a type because before I mentioned that I worked in an ice cream store, while I was working in the ice cream store, the guy came in once with the dude. And I just looked at the dude. I was like, I just shook my head. I was like, dude, don't do it.
Don't do it.
just go home. Just go home. Whatever, however he got you here, just go home. I think that there are better ways to pick up dudes, unless trying to get a straight boy is your thing. I'm guessing that if you followed him around or made a documentary about him, he would probably be trying to pick up other guys who looked kind of like you.
Right. Yes. He was definitely had an Asian fetish because he did talk about, oh, Where are you from? I guess that's what people would say back then.
Yeah.
Where are you from? I'm Chinese. That's what I usually knew what people were asking. So yeah. I was like, oh yeah, I'm half Chinese. I mean, I would see him all the time. The craziest time I saw him though, is I was in grad school and me and my whole family were in Chicago at a restaurant, you know, like for lunch, like just like hot dog stand. And guess who walks by?
What?
Yes.
In Chicago?
In Chicago, like in downtown Chicago. He like walks by, he looks in the window, he like recognizes me and he comes in and I was just like, hey, how's it going?
He's like, hot dogs, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like, I love this place. So I was like, oh, that's great. And then he's like, and then he kind of like just stared silently at me for about, I don't know, it seemed like forever, but it was probably only like 10 seconds. And he's like, okay. And then he just like walked away. And everybody's like, who is that? And then of course I got to tell
the story came out. Yeah.
I was like, that guy, oh my gosh, you can't believe that.
Boudoir.
Speaking of which, there were a lot of people that were working in the photo lab. You come across a lot of like nude photographs of people.
That does not shock me.
The coworkers. Yeah. Yeah. And it would always be like, hey, you know, because it'd be like, you know, a middle-aged guy with like all these pictures of young naked women, and you'd be like, oh yeah, this is, you know, this is
art.
Art. And I was like,
it's okay. Not art.
Yeah, I was definitely found that odd.
It's not art.
So yeah, there's a whole world of that. I'm a photographer.
But yeah, so this is my, what is this? The fourth one.
Mm-hmm,
this
mm-hmm.
is the fourth one. And what I've learned so far is it's more or less a confirmation of something that I guess is fairly obvious, probably to most people, but maybe not. But sometimes it's good to reiterate these obvious truths. Before we get to the next phase of your career, I just want to ask you what you think about formulas for success. do you feel like a success? Like it, so far it sounds to me like your path is not particularly goal-based, which is something that I can wholeheartedly relate to. What are your thoughts about that?
About like if I were giving advice to somebody you know, moving forward. Well, I mean, as a teacher, I am asked this like often, right? Like, oh, how do I become a successful artist, or how to become a successful?
Please let me know, you know, after the podcast.
Right? It's like, yeah, how do I do this? How do I do that? And I also get that from the parents too. Like, how is my kid going to like not move back in with me? And
monetize. Monetize.
What I usually do, I used to be like, oh yeah, you should, you know, work really hard, try to figure out what your passion is, apply to those jobs and find out what you don't like to do. You know, as I said earlier, I like, that's kind of like how I moved through life. I was like, well, I definitely don't want to do that.
Right.
So that was like, it's like a process of elimination. But if it comes to art, like the key success is what I often say, which I, again, I'm always doubting myself, especially as I get older. So I don't know what I say makes any sense. But some of the students come back to me years later and say like, oh, Dave, like I took your advice. I was like, oh man, that's
what did I
crazy.
Say?
Yeah. And, you know, and it's usually just like one liner. It's like, keep making art. and they're like, Dave, that sentence goes through my head every day. I'm like, oh man, I got to really be careful about what I say. But yeah. Like, but the statistic, and I used to like say like, you know, this art thing's like really interesting. Like I went to undergrad, I met all these like great artists, like people that I thought were some of the best artists. They were going to be like the biggest success right. you've ever heard. Like I was like, they're totally. Going to be the next.
And they probably are very, very good.
Yeah.
Or maybe not.
No, they were inspiring.
Yeah.
But as we were joking about earlier, you know, taking an art class because it was easy was like kind of, you know, what people thought they were doing. But to be an artist and
not easy, you
know, not easy, because like few people even know what that means.
No. Right?
Especially if you're not an artist. And then even if they kind of know what it means, they definitely don't value it.
I think that most people, when they hear that you're an artist, they automatically assume that you're a painter.
Yeah, you're like a painter, like Picasso or Caravaggio or something like that. So you get like a lot of just like blank stares after that. you know, we were again joking about like setting goals, and I never ever thought of myself as like setting too many goals. But as I've like kind of gone through life, there are like these kind of markers, right? So I'd say they're more setting goals to like, you know, fulfill the time within the next 4 years. So for example, my friend Eric Mead, who, you know, reflected to me about my life in a way that I never like articulated to him, but he's like, you know, Dave, you just like set goals and you just like do them. Like, you're like, I'm going to go to grad school in Madison, Wisconsin and become like a printmaker or whatever. And she's like, then you went and did it. He's like, true. I don't do stuff like that. You just like, you have like these kind of like longer term goals. And then he's like, and then you were like, oh, I'm going to go teach in Boston. And then you went and did it.
That wasn't really a goal like, though, was it?
No,
for did me, you ever like, think about like, working in Boston?
In my head, it was like, what am I going to do now for the next like 4 years of my life since I just graduated from grad school? And I was like, well, I guess the next step is to go to New York City and become like a famous artist or like try to make a living. But then Cassie, my wife, was still in grad school. And so I couldn't just like move to New York yet. And then this opportunity came to be a teacher at Wellesley. Teaching was never one of my goals. Like in my head, I was I'm going to go to grad school and become a teacher. That was like the last thing in my mind. Actually, I was like, I'm going to keep my job at the photo lab.
Forever. That's what I was thinking. Yeah. I would take that job and keep it forever, I think.
Yeah. I actually took a leave of absence.
Oh, you didn't even quit.
I didn't even quit because you could take a leave of absence to go get a term, like a degree.
Yeah.
Like that was like a part of the union deal.
Nice.
Like
a regulation. Protecting the worker.
Yeah, protecting the worker. I could take 2 years and still have my job.
That is,
because I love that job.
Yeah, man. That's a pretty sweet job. Well, that's the thing. Like, I think also for an arts-based guy, like that, those type of jobs are the holy grail.
Yeah.
You get them and then you hold on to them and then you keep them forever. You know, I used to work at Wellesley. If I didn't leave Boston, I'd probably still be there doing that job because why wouldn't I? I know that at MassArt, Steve Terlente is the lab guy there. You know, he got a Guggenheim while working as the lab guy at MassArt. Yeah. You know, that's crazy, right?
Yeah.
I don't even know if he's still there. I assume he's still there, but I don't know. I don't know why he wouldn't be still there. That's what I'm saying. Because it's just too good.
Yeah, it was just too good. And I love that job. And my sister actually inherited that job after I left.
Does she still have it?
No, because unfortunately, black and white print photo labs are not like...
They don't do that anymore.
It's like, and then the other like big part of that job was to make slides for faculty, which also... And
what's a slide?
Yeah, so they did shut that entire department down.
Brutal, but they still need to make copies of things, don't they? Or do they just not have a department for that? Or they just downsized?
They just downsized. Like technically, because she was in the union, she could have stayed at the University of Washington doing some other job. And I think she did work for like the TV station for a little bit.
Oh, that's cool.
But, you know, it wasn't the job that she like wanted to do. So she, you know, gave up that job security, right, I guess, to pursue other things. And I think she's happier for it in her case. I know, black and white photo.
It's a magical thing. It's a magical thing, but unfortunately it is increasingly less and less relevant. Although there is a movement amongst the kids to do analog stuff. It's not quite to the level of collecting LPs for listening to music.
I was just going
to
say, vinyl records is like,
but it's still, the people do it. You know, I'm sure that if you, there are hashtags you can look up on Instagram to find out what the kids are into. A lot of the time when I see that stuff, I just think it's funny. Some of the terminology that they use, I think it's funny that people call records or LPs vinyls, like not vinyl, vinyls. Like,
vinyls.
I don't know if that's like an accepted term or if I just think it's funny because I'm old. But I've never heard, until recently, I'd never heard anybody refer to records as vinyls. They were always records to me until I met some sophisticated record collectors who called them LPs. And then I started calling them LPs because I wanted to sound sophisticated. Because I'm a sophisticated guy. Believe it or not, I'm super sophisticated.
The Luddite in here, LP stands for long play. Is that right?
That is correct, Dave. That is correct.
Okay. I've never confirmed this. I just, assumed it.
Yeah.
So you could also be collecting EPs, right?
That would be extended play, but I think that those would be called, if they're the full 10 inch size, yeah. I guess they would be called, I don't know. I'm not, that's not really my thing. I know the 45s are the little ones with the big hole.
Yeah.
Or 7 inches, like with the hardcore kids used to call them 7 inches.
7 inches. Yeah.
Yeah, I got the youth of today, 7 inch. and then old people. When I say old people, I'm not referring to me. I'm referring to people older than me, which is hard to imagine. But they call them 45s, I believe. And that's, 45s. But the hardcore kids call them 7 inches. The indie rockers call them 7 inches. Actually, I don't even know. I don't know.
Yeah, 7 inches or singles, I think, were the other.
Or singles. Singles, terms, right. Yeah. Do you, right. Yeah, remember cuss singles?
Oh, yes, I do.
I never had any, but that, I mean, it just seems kind of worthless to me. Just buy the whole tape.
Well, sometimes they would give them out for free.
That's true.
That was like the free thing at the counter. You'd be like, what's this? It's like, oh, it's awesome. You should take it.
Check it out. It's the new hotness. All the kids are talking about it. All the kids. All right. So how was greatness thrust upon you? You've been moving through life. Eric seems to think that you're highly goal oriented, and I guess long game, maybe you are, but it seems to me that there's a lot of happenstance and serendipity and opportunity that you grab onto, opportunities that you grab onto rather than I'm going for the goal. And, you know, like I'm saying this like mostly because I used to work at Wellesley. You currently work at Wellesley. And we both know that the students who go to Wellesley are laser focused.
Yes.
On they have. Whatever they think success is. And for them, success is generally making six figures right out of college.
Right.
Which and is
they usually
crazy.
It is crazy because they ask like, hey, can I get your advice? I was like, oh yeah, sure. And then they like discuss like, oh, should I go to grad school or should I take this job where I get paid six figures? I was like, definitely take the job.
Take the money.
Just do that for a little bit, pay off your loans, and then you can go to grad school.
But a lot of these kids don't even have loans. That's the thing. I don't want to get into class here, but it's like a lot of those people don't have to worry about loans.
Right. And that's just, again, my
mindset.
Thinking about like how do you look outside your own experiences, which
you can. And that's why I ask people where they're coming from. Like a lot of the kids that go to Wellesley, I think there's a lot of parental pressure. I, for instance, and it sounds like maybe you did not have a whole ton of parental pressure. They're just like, awesome, fill out the application. I hope it works out for you. Whereas maybe a student at Wellesley, their mom or dad or guardian or whatever they call them these days was signing up for prep courses, talking to the dean, you know, like doing the network thing, making the magic happen behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And that just was not something that I ever knew about or thought about or even thought could exist.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the only bar I had to get over growing up is my dad said he would never bail me out of jail. So that was like, well, I guess
noted.
That's a goal.
Don't go to jail.
My mom, on the other hand, she was the term that is commonly used for Chinese mothers is like tiger mom. So she definitely,
there's a book.
Yeah. She definitely pressured me into not doing what I currently do, but mostly it was,
who's laughing now?
Yeah, right. But yeah, she wanted me to be rich. And like, that's all that really mattered. There was one point where I told her I wanted to be a doctor. She's like, why would you ever want to be a doctor? That's like such a sad job. You're just dealing with sick people all the time. And then like years later, she was like thinking of considering getting plastic surgery. She's like, Dave, you should definitely become a doctor. Fix my face. I was like, that's
okay.
That ship has sailed.
Well, not necessarily. You know, Andrew's friend Dan went back and became a doctor in his mid-30s, was it?
Yeah.
That was nuts.
And then he moved to Pittsburgh. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm moving to Pittsburgh to go to medical school.
Okay, dude.
Like, wow. That is That is ambitious.
Anything is possible.
Yeah. I like that guy.
I only met him a couple times, but yeah, he's pretty laid back dude, but I was just kind of blown away that was his thing.
Yeah. But it's great being in, you know, academia, because you get to see people that like are not like me, that like were able to like set really great goals and succeed. You know, we know some of these. I mean, you worked at Wellesley at the same time when I think of like the most successful students, and they were just like really, really great artists in ways that like I don't think will ever be, like Alia Rodman and Laura Weil. They just like are unhinged art makers. Yeah. You know? Like they like had no. They seem to have like no bounds or like no fear, you know. And a lot of the decisions I think I made in my life was the fear of not going to jail.
I think that there's a difference, but that also could come down to class. I'm not going to pretend to know the details of everybody's financial background, but you know, and I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing that if you have a bit of security that you can, you know, go whole hog into something. Personally, I was obviously not passionate enough to do that. I didn't feel like I had the support network for it. But now, like as an old guy, I'm thinking, I mean, like, so what was I going to lose?
Yeah, right. You like look back and like,
like, yeah. What was I afraid of? It's not like I made it to the top of the mountain at this point by not taking any of those risks. And now I'm unemployed and looking for it and getting rejected from jobs that I could easily do, but they don't think that they want me. And it's just depressing. And now there are more barriers in place because of family and stuff that make it more difficult. So yeah, like I kind of feel like now I'm in a similar place that I was in my 20s almost.
Yeah.
Except right? That I have responsibilities now and I had no responsibilities then. And
yeah, well, now it's not only you, right? I mean, I have a family too. I have, you know, two kids that are close in age to your kids. And yep. it's not about what I want to do anymore.
No.
What, you know, it's about like what we need to do in order to, you know, survive. So yeah, so that is, yeah, I always like that quote is always like, so it all sticks in my head. I can't remember what movie it is or book. Basically, when you have children, you die and you just pass your soul and your dreams and your hopes on your children.
It's like, I hope I'm doing that.
Yeah.
I think I'm just passing anxiety on to them. Poor kids. They're going to hate me someday. They love me now, but someday they're going to resent me hard. Oh, sorry, guys.
I always tell people, too, as far as like what it takes to be successful, is like, you know, all you have to do is really, it's like going to sound so cliche or canned, but like all you have to do is do what you say you're going to do. It seems like that's like not a,
that's like that's what everything hinges on.
Yeah. It's like not a quality that's like particularly useful. Maybe this is where I feel antiquated. Like, I mean, this like concept of ghosting, and I mean, I was just ghosted by a client like a couple weeks ago. And I think that's like, to me, that's like so strange that that's acceptable. So when I do a project, a lot of the times my critique of what I do is like, it's like so amazing working with you, Dave, because you like do what you say you're going to do. It's like
crazy.
So refreshing.
You know, like, yep, like, I do, and it's awesome. That's why you love me.
Yeah, Jesus. Like that's why I keep on getting more jobs or more exhibitions or more commissions, because like I propose something, they look at it, they're like, oh, will you change this and that, and I change these things to like make the piece, you know, less horrifying or more inviting or whatever you want to call it. And then
I think it should be more horrifying.
And then I paint it or, you know, make it, and you know, they're happy and whatever. And like, I just don't even think that that's something that like people deal with a lot. I always hear about like, oh yeah, I hired this guy or this person and they just stop showing up. Yeah. Like, you know, you hear that over and over again from everybody from every kind of job, you name it. You know, if you're like a plumber or a construction worker to like,
they just disappear.
You know, Uber delivery person, like, I ordered groceries and
where are my groceries? Yeah. Yeah, no, okay. So right. So yeah, just showing up is key.
Oh yeah, that is a big one. That is a big one.
That's the secret to success. I'm going to put that on the list. I'm going to have a website for this thing. I'm going to compile a list of secrets for success, and just showing up is going to be very high on the list of secrets for success. I have to get going soon. I have to pick up the kids.
Yeah,
and soon. But I'm not done yet. I want to talk a little bit about the alchemy of your current position, the alchemy and the genesis of your current position, because I think that that's rather interesting in that you started teaching at Wellesley at a time when 3D was this thing that nobody knew anything about. So you had gone through all your schooling, you have a master's degree in printmaking, you are a master fine artist, yet because your dad has this engineering design background, you also knew how to use AutoCAD, right?
Right.
So
right.
How does that
turn
into the Dave Olson empire?
Yeah, serendipity, right? You know, a lot of it is just like timing. I mean, it's timing and then like showing some interest in it. So back when I was young, like really young, when I was thinking I wanted to go to the military, my father was a naval architect. He used to just be at a drawing board with a pencil and paper, you know, making drawings of ships all day long. But he worked for a large corporation called American President's Lines. They made shipping containers and they made ships, like container ships. They're like, we got to get the newest technology. So, you know, in 1984, they bought like a mainframe system and, you know, said like, Gary, you have to start learning how to use the computer. You got to start learning AutoCAD on the computer. And I was like, I don't like that. But he's like, but I guess I have to do this to keep my job. So he would, lo and behold, he was a single father. So he would take my sister and I to Oakland, California, to this corporation to go work on the weekends or whenever he needed to. And he didn't have childcare. So we would go there. You know, I think there was like two of these workstations where you would like draw some lines and then you'd press refresh and then you'd go and have a coffee, because like just for the screen to refresh, it took like a few minutes. And I guess it was a little bit faster than drawing with a pen and pencil and paper, but not much. So it was like, so I like became familiar with this technology way back when. And then when I got to high school, I took drafting class and they had like two computers in the back. And I was like, what do these computers have on? And he's like, oh, they have AutoCAD. He's like, I was like, I know how to use AutoCAD.
Like, the teacher's really? Like, I don't.
Yeah. He's like, well, yeah, you should use them. And so like, he's like, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, my dad's a naval, like, my dad's was designing ferries now. This is like Oakland to Seattle to right. Bellingham. So I think I'm going to translate these 2D drawings into 3D on AutoCAD. And he's like, okay.
Go for it.
Yeah. He's like, had no idea like this was even possible, right? Because it was just drawing lines.
Yeah.
So in the drafting class, I was also like just doing isometric and all kinds of, you know, drawings by hand. So I was like, I could do this in the computer. So I started translating these ship designs into 3D, and I would like make these like scenes with like the ferry boat, like in the ocean with light. You know, it took days to like render like one image. I was like, I loved it. I was like,
but
oh,
that
yes.
wasn't a problem because nobody else was using the computer. So
yeah, nobody else even touched the damn thing. And so I would do these things. And so I had like a floppy disk with all these like 3D things on them. And then they'd ask me if I knew how to use computers. They'd be like, oh yeah, look, I have some, it's like, oh, I have a floppy disk full of these images. Or I think I had a GeoCities account. So I had some nice. Images online Classic. Too, as time went on. And so in that photo lab, the other thing they wanted to do at some point was I was like, you know, printing negatives and so on and so forth. They also needed to move into the future. So they bought Mac clone.
Oh yeah. You know, like a Quanta.
I can't remember the company, but they had these Mac clones back then. And we got the most expensive Mac clone, but they didn't know how to use it. They're like, does anyone in this office know how to use this thing? And I was like, I don't know how to use computers. So I just like did negatives half the time. And then I was like the computer guy the other half the time. Oh. I was like, scanning the slides now, scanning the negatives, burning CDs,
yeah,
you know, using Photoshop, touching up these
like Photoshop 3
images.
Or something.
Yeah. Early technology. So I was doing this computer work. Eventually, I guess like the thing that like carried on until like what my career is now is, it's always like empty computer labs, which is like kind of the common thread here, or computers that aren't being used. So my friends in the printmaking class named Aaron Neely, he was taking this like 3D animation class at the UW. And I was like, well, that sounds cool. He's like, show me what he was working on. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, I know how to make 3D models. He's like, well, you should take the class. Like, nobody knows how to use this stuff. I was like, yeah, that sounds awesome. I'm going to totally do that. So I signed up for this class. It's a year-long class. It's called Animation Production Series. This is like my sixth or seventh year of undergrad. So
nice.
Yeah, I didn't tell everybody that too in this interview. I had that photo lab job that allowed me to take courses.
Just take classes forever.
So I just like also just took classes. And so I took this class for free because it was a part of I get to take one class per quarter for free. So I took this 3D animation class and yeah, I knew what I was doing. I was able to like make these 3D models. I was able to learn the animation software because I had this background and they were all like, wow, you should teach the course next year.
Right.
So I was like,
I should. You're right. I should.
Yeah. Oh, this sounds awesome. So the next year I became one of the TAs for the course. And then I like got my first, it wasn't my first teaching experience, but it was definitely my first teaching experience in college. I helped the students learn the technology and, you know, then I learned how to animate and I had the opportunity to apprentice under a gentleman named Frank Thomas, who was one of the original seven Disney animators.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I'd fly down to LA to this guy's house. He was in like his 80s and he would like look at my animations and tell me if they were good or bad. And
what do you know, old man?
Yeah. And so I liked it. I was good at it. So I did it.
Right.
But I thought like maybe I could get a job doing it. But I was like, I don't know. You know, maybe I like my photo lab job.
Right. You know? Sweet job.
So I never thought about that. But then just to kind of move forward. So in grad school, I'm studying printmaking. And I'm doing like lots of stuff. I'm kind of using the computer a little bit, but it's not like 3D animation. But there was this empty computer lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Can you imagine? Empty computer lab?
Yeah. And I was like, what are all these computers doing here? He's like, oh, the gentleman who started this lab, he unfortunately passed away. His name was George Kramer. He was the sculpture professor there who like wanted to like move ahead into the future. Right?
Right,
he wanted
right.
people to learn how to sculpt with computers. So I was like, well, can I use the lab? And they're like, yeah, go for it. Like nobody else is using it. They're like, you know
That's
how to
amazing.
Use it? I'm like, yeah.
That is truly amazing.
I know how to use the computer. So this is my final, this is my third year of grad school. So I was thinking of a project to do and I did a 3D animation instead of printmaking. The faculty there are like, why are you doing printmaking? This is way better than your printmaking. Because a lot of people just were like fascinated with technology, right? They're like, how did you do this? This is like so crazy. And I was like, it's not that crazy. And then, and that's also the connection to Wellesley. So I'm sitting in this computer lab by myself working on the 3D animation. And this woman walks by and says, hey, what are you up to? And I was like, oh, I'm making these 3D animations. And she goes, well, what do you think about teaching? I was like, yeah, I've thought about it. You know, I mean, I was teaching 2D design at the university at the time. And she goes, well, you should come work at Wellesley College. I'm going on sabbatical next year. And I like the stuff that you're doing. I think it'd be great. You could totally do my job. And I was like, yeah, sounds cool. And then
I'll just go.
Yeah. And that's it. That's how I got my job at Wellesley College is because
it's a little bit more involved than that. But
yes,
we don't need to talk about that here.
Yeah.
Because that's another, we can talk about that maybe in another podcast. Maybe you can be a recurring guest.
Yeah.
I think it's good to reiterate that skill set in terms of 3D in the art world was taboo at that time. I mean, not taboo. It's not taboo. It was just new and nobody knew how to do it. The fact that you had those skills made you a commodity.
It was, yeah. I mean, that first year, I had 20 interviews.
Yeah, I know. I remember.
College, 20.
It was crazy. You had like spindles of CDs that you were sending out. I remember to job applications and stuff in the pain cave.
Yeah, in the pain cave. And it was like mind boggling. I was like, so many interviews. It's because I was like just on the, you know, the razor's edge or whatever you call it. Like I was just right there, dude, at the right time.
I'm just gonna say this: there were so many times I thought you were gonna crash and burn, but you kept going on to the right side of the fence. It's just like nope. It's like, oh, that's it, this is Dave's last semester. Nope,
no,
he's still here. Nope. Yeah. And then you're doing job interviews and stuff of like, Dave's leaving. Nope. And then bang, we got it. He's there.
Yeah, he's there.
it was quite, anyway, just for the rest of you, it was quite a journey for Dave to get to where he is now. He has a very good job at a very good school. I'm going to, these are closing remarks now.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that the theme of this episode, the theme of this conversation is timing, experience, and showing up.
Exactly.
Thank you, Dave, for doing this. I hope everything keeps going well when you go back from your sabbatical.
Thanks, Jim. And I mean, you are like one of the most talented, you know, hardworking people I have ever met. And, you know, and I really
wish you were hiring.
Friendship. Yeah, right.
If
I can hire somebody for anything, it would be Jim. And heck, I have hired Jim in the past.
Yes. And actually, just one last thing before we stop, that's actually something that I want to talk about because, you know, I got some time. I want to make a website about our road trip.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's totally nonlinear because at this time, it's so long ago that I can't tell the story in a linear way. So I feel like I want to grab pictures and movies and all kinds of different things from that trip and then write about them, how we remember them, like not even where did this happen? Cause half the time, I don't know where it happened. I don't know where the hell we were. I mean, I know the ones that were in Mike's apartment and I know the ones that are in the Badlands cause they're bison there. So I want to write stuff about it, but then like, I thought it would be cool if you contributed to the writing as well. And also maybe, I don't know what pictures you have, but I'm sure I have more pictures than you've seen because I gave you plenty of them, but there's so many, like I've been looking through them and editing some of them now and there's some stuff.
Yeah.
It can be a cool site.
Yeah. I have those Facebook clips.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there are things. Hopefully that 500 gig hard drive have anything special, but I'm sure that they're all somewhere. But yeah, that stuff was all time stamped. You know, the other thing is I have that time lapse of our drive that I never did anything with.
Right, exactly. You know? Like, that's what I mean. Like, there's all this stuff and it never did anything. I had it's not even that I didn't have time. It was right before my first kid was born and there was time, believe me.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what not having time meant. So yeah, we should do that. And thanks again. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. I'm sure when we're done with this, I'm just going to say, oh, I was supposed to say this, but you know, that's just how it goes. Just like when you wreck someone's film in the film lab.
Exactly.
You just have to accept it. Do you have anything to say?
No, just, this is awesome. This was great. No, it's good. It's like fun chatting. These moments have been important.
We should definitely chat more often.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to meeting in person again because you were actually supposed to be here this year.
Yeah, I was supposed to move to Rotterdam. My kids were enrolled in school.
God damn it.
We were supposed to spend the year plotting and doing some, you know, crazy thing.
I was thinking that we could, I mean, maybe not to the extent of the last trip, but like my in-laws have a camper and they don't do anything with it most of the year.
I know, we could have done all kinds of random stuff that would have been awesome, but there'll be another opportunity. I have a feeling.
All right, thank you again.
All right, buddy, take care.
Okay, that was pretty long, but I think it's pretty good. Maybe I just think it's pretty good because it was me talking with a friend.
but I hope you got something out of it. I think most people think it's fun to hang out with Dave. He's a great guy, and he deserves all the good things. Just like the intro, I'm going to keep the outro rather short, but you can find me on social media at feelfreetodeviate.com. When I say social media, I mean Instagram and Facebook, but you know, let me know if you think I should be on some other social media. I'm really hoping you don't say TikTok. But maybe I'd be good at that. I don't know. Maybe TikTok is the key to success. The next episode in line is another old friend named Ed Mubarak, the legend. The episode is a little bit more chaotic, and it's great, but I'm thinking maybe I should break it up and push him into the future, because having too many dudes that I'm buddies with might offset the purpose of the podcast. So I'm going to see what I can do about getting somebody else in here. All right, thanks for listening to Feel Free to Deviate. Until next time.